From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from St. Peter Claver Church in Baltimore, Maryland.
And, of course, the fishiest thing is the war on terrorism, which is a big swindle. It's not a war on terrorism at all. A war on terrorism by the United States is impossible because we're the number one terrorists.
Legendary peace activist Philip Berrigan will be laid to rest today in Baltimore, Maryland. Today, we'll hear his voice through the years, as well as those of others who engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience actions with him for the past quarter of a century. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Baltimore as we await the funeral of Philip Berrigan. I'm Amy Goodman. Jesse Jackson has called on Republican Senate leader Trent Lott to resign after Lott lamented the fact that Strom Thurmond didn't win the presidential election in 1948 when he ran on a pro-segregation, anti-civil rights platform. At a 100th birthday party for Senator Thurmond, Lott said, "I want to say this about my state. When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all of these years either." According to the Chicago Tribune, there was an audible gasp in the room, followed by a general silence. Thurmond's platform in 1948 read in part, "We stand for the segregation of the races." During one campaign speech, he said, "There's not enough troops in the Army to force the Southern people to break down segregation and admit the Negro race into our theaters, into our swimming pools, into our homes, and into our churches." Asked to comment on Lott's recent remarks, Gordon Baum, chief executive of the Council of Conservative Citizens, said, "God bless Trent Lott." The New York Times is reporting that Bush administration officials are privately conceding they have no single piece of intelligence that proves Iraq has continued to acquire nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. Over the weekend, Iraq issued a 12,000-page report to the United Nations that flatly denied it possessed such weapons. Iraq did admit it came close to developing a nuclear bomb and that it had developed chemical and biological weapons before the Persian Gulf War. Any failure to provide a full declaration about its alleged weapons of mass destruction could provide the catalyst for a U.S. attack. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is pressing the United Nations to intensify its weapons inspections by doubling the number of inspectors and by accepting U-2 spy planes staffed by U.S. pilots for surveillance operations. The U.S. will soon have enough heavy tanks, warships, aircraft, bombs, and troops in the Persian Gulf to begin an attack against Iraq sometime in January. This according to the New York Times. President Bush is reportedly set to nominate Jon Snow, the head of railroad giant CSX, to head the Treasury Department. This comes 3 days after Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and White House Economic Policy Coordinator Lawrence Lindsay were forced to resign. Unlike O'Neill, Snow is an insider in both the worlds of Washington and corporate America. A recent USA Today study found him to be the nation's most interconnected CEO. In addition to serving as head of CSX, he has direct ties to 20 other corporations in the United States. And as we broadcast today's program, a special happy birthday to producer Chris Abrams.
My name is Philip Berrigan. In World War II, I flew the bombing missions. Now with every blow I strike today, I say the bombs will never fall again. I hear the prophet's cry of hope ring through the prison wall. We've waited 30 centuries to see that hammer fall. If we think we've got 30 more, we cannot see at all. For swords into plowshare, the hammer has to fall. Carl Cabot is my name. I have lived and worked among the third world peoples. I've seen corporations flourish.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, Resistance Radio, broadcasting from St. Peter Claver Church in Baltimore, Maryland.
There was a wake for Philip Berrigan here last night. Today, there will be a funeral for him. On Friday night, surrounded by family and friends, Phil Berrigan died. He was 79 years old. He died of liver and kidney cancer. Phil Berrigan and his brother, Father Dan Berrigan, gained national prominence during the Vietnam War when they and a group of others went to Catonsville, Maryland, and burned draft files with homemade napalm. For the next quarter of a century, he engaged in more than 100 actions. Over the last 30 years, 11 of those years, he has spent in jail. Today, we will spend listening to his voice over the years, and then the voices of others who have gathered here in Baltimore to remember him. This is Philip Berrigan in a piece that was produced by Laurel Paget Seekins and Scott Gurian of Pacifica's Peace Watch.
I'm a World War II veteran. I was commissioned as an infantry officer in France in 1944. Because of my involvement in the military for about 3.5 years and my participation in the European theater of operations, I had to slowly unlearn many of the lessons and falsehoods that I had picked up. This took a long and laborious course. I came home and at the behest of my family went to Holy Cross College and then entered the Josephite Seminary in the same year. And after 5 years, I was ordained a Catholic priest. And then my true education began, I believe. Our apostolate was to African Americans, and most of our missions and schools were in the Deep South. Black people began to educate me. So I joined the civil rights struggle and became active in the Deep South. In Selma, Alabama, in New Orleans, Montgomery, Alabama, and many other places. From that, I learned about the war in Vietnam and African-American participation in it. While teaching in New Orleans at a black high school, I saw my students recruited by the Air Force and by the Army and Marines and other branches of the service, thinking nothing of it in those days. But nonetheless, the lessons of the civil rights movement struck deeply into me and found a chord of response, especially the nonviolence of Martin Luther King. He, in turn, of course, was highly influenced by the nonviolence of Jesus and by Gandhi. In a very true sense, the civil rights leaders taught me. I became active against the war in about 1962. Through legal measures, mostly. I did not learn about civil disobedience until the mid-60s. In 1967, while the March on the Pentagon happened, I went with three other friends to the Baltimore Customs House, and we poured our blood on 1A draft files. For this, we were indicted, went to trial, while Baltimore and Washington and New York City and other major American cities burned because of the assassination of Martin Luther King in early 1968. I was awaiting sentencing for the Baltimore Customs House action when we drew together, several of us, the Catonsville Nine. And we went to a suburb of Baltimore and we this time took the 1A files out of the draft boards there and burned them in a parking lot outside.
Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread.
The Catonsville Nine was one of the defining actions of the movement against the Vietnam War. The image of nine Americans, two of them Catholic priests, burning a pile of over 600 draft files with homemade napalm shocked the country.
For this, I was given a 6-year sentence and was denied bail and went to jail in May of 1968. I was released on bail about Christmas time of 1968 and then began to work solidly against the war, participating with friends in the formation of draft board raiding groups, nonviolent raiding groups, and did this until ordered to surrender in April of 1970. My brother, myself, George Mishy, and Mary Moyland at this point went underground.
While he was underground, Phil made a recording explaining his reasoning for refusing to report to prison. The tape was played on Pacifica Station WBAI in April of 1970.
We have trouble with surrender, even as we have trouble with official notions of crime or justice. Because this government refuses to represent the poor or blacks or students, it does not represent us. If it were truly representative, we would not be sent to jail, nor would it suppress our black brothers and sisters, and send to battlefield murder or to death our young brothers, and then suck dry for profit's sake our poor brothers here and abroad. And so it becomes a problem to us, as it has to the remainder of the world, placing us all in a common dilemma of survival.
Phil was caught by the FBI after 2 weeks.
I started serving my time at Lewisburg Penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, and was there until August or September of that year when I was switched to Danbury Federal Institution in Danbury, Connecticut, and was there for the next 2.5 to 3 years.
Even after the end of the Vietnam War, Berrigan continued his active resistance to U.S. militarism and nuclear weapons. He estimates he took part in over 100 actions in the next 40 years. In 1980, he, along with 7 others, started the International Plowshares Disarmament Movement when they entered a General Electric plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania.
We had friends up in Media, PA, that had been demonstrating at Plant Number 9, General Electric, for about 2 years. So they suggested that the prophecy of Isaiah might be implemented there, and it was a completely new idea to us that we would be expected to take the initiative when the government wasn't willing to do that and beat swords into plowshares, beat nuclear weapons into scrap. We knew nothing about the guts of the plant, what the layout was. In any event, we tried to go in with the workers at about 7 a.m. Two of our number distracted the guard in the vestibule of the plant, and then others filed into the plant proper. And it took us about 10 seconds. Jean Chouchard went into a non-destructible testing room there, and there they were. So we began to work on them immediately, and then it broadened out a bit, and we were pouring blood on classified blueprints, and we were destroying tools that had been specially made to work on the Mark 12A. I think faith has a great deal to do with always finding the weapons and always doing what you intend to do to them, because they're so anti-human, and because the God we try to be faithful to is all about the human. We say God is a God of compassion.
We say that these are annihilatory weapons. They're true weapons of mass destruction. And we believe that they're the taproot of violence in the West here, because any people who would make the decision and would learn to love the company of the bomb and its use in certain circumstances against another people are mad. And we still haven't been able to understand, you know, the psychic or the spiritual effect of loving the bomb here in this country. And that's one of the things you free yourself of when you do a plowshares action. You no longer love the bomb. You've taken some measures against it. Yet you're saying, look, I won't pay for it. I won't work on it. See, I won't feed it with my silence. I won't remain passive while it exists. You're saying all of those things, and you're liberating yourself from that bomb.
Philip Berrigan married Liz McAllister, and together they started Jonah House, a Catholic community in Baltimore, Maryland, dedicated to resisting nuclear weapons.
It's a nonviolent, very simply, a nonviolent resistance community. We don't say one of our priorities is serving the poor, though we do an awful lot of work in behalf of the poor. We hold all things in common. We practice voluntary poverty. We work with our hands to earn what we need for our living and our work. And that means supporting any effort towards resistance and peace. And it's been that way now since 1973. The community has paid quite a sizable price, not only in actions, but also in jail time. We speak of a revolving door between prison and what we call minimum security, which is living in this society.
Along with community, Phil saw the need for a deeply committed peace movement.
You know, you don't build a movement without people. You don't have a movement unless essential education, both moral and political, of a very, very high quality is extended. Building a movement or building a revolution is essentially a community operation, as I see it. So there again, I would focus on a politics that would build a movement because it would influence people, bring them to a higher level of consciousness and a higher degree of risk in their lives, realizing that their identity is impossible unless they take risk for their brothers.
In one of the last interviews he gave, Phil was optimistic about the growing movement against the possible U.S. war on Iraq.
I'm very, very, very hopeful. Very hopeful. Because, you know, we all experienced 9/11, and we did realize the plurality that Bush had by way of support, and we did see the country go crazy with flags and all of that. Well, now a lot of that is being taken back, and people are beginning to, in a very sobering and responsible way, they're beginning to rock back on their heels and say, there's something fishy about this. And, of course, the fishiest thing is the war on terrorism, which is a big swindle. It's not a war on terrorism at all. A war on terrorism by the United States is impossible because we're the number one terrorists. It's impossible. Absolutely impossible.
As we hold up Philip Berrigan, we mustn't leave out the many who accompanied him on his journey. The folks who went to prison with him, the many who've been a part of the Jonah House community, his partner Liz McAllister, and their three children who know all too well the challenges of a life of resistance. As he passes, may his vision and life assist us in finding our own paths to creating a nonviolent world.
And all my country saw were priests who broke the law. First it was a question, then it was a mission. How to be American, how to be a Christian.
That piece was produced by Laurel Padgett Seekins and Scott Gurian of Pacifica's Peace Watch. Also, thanks to Tom Goodnow of Radio for Peace International and Brian DeShazer of the Pacifica Radio Archives. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Co-defendants, I'd build up there again. Oh, and only a layman's batch of napalm. We pulled the draft files out, we burned them in the parking lot. Better the files than the bodies of children. They had no right before the love of you.
Was 79 years old. On the altar of the church are some of the tools, you could say, of Philip Berrigan's trade. Among them, hammers, both he used as a painter and also to disarm nuclear warheads, to symbolically do this. The one with the evidence ticket on it was actually used by another Plowshares activist named Kathy Boylan in 1991 on the USS Gettysburg. Next to that, on the altar, is a plowshare that was given to Philip Berrigan and his wife Liz McAllister that was found on Block Island, where Father Dan Berrigan, was picked up by federal authorities after the Catonsville action of 1968. Right now, we're going to go back in time to speak with some of the people who engaged in various nonviolent civil disobedience actions with Philip Berrigan, or simply were inspired by him. Plowshares activist Kathy Boylan will join us, but first, we'll go to Tom Lewis, who was involved in both the Catonsville Nine, where draft records were burned, and also the Baltimore Four in 1967. This is Tom Lewis.
I met Philip Berrigan in this church where he's where the wake is and where he will be taken to be buried tomorrow. Philip had been transferred to this church for speaking out against the war. This is an inner city church in Baltimore, St. Peter Claver. We had been working in the civil rights movement. When we were working against the war in Vietnam, which was escalating at that time, draft resistors were being sent to jail. Those who refused to go were being sent to jail for 2 years. People burnt their draft cards, and they were sent to jail for 2 years. We realized, in a history of nonviolence and also by their witness, that we needed to take greater risk. So we formed the Baltimore Four Witness, which involved the United Church of Christ minister Jim Mingle, Philip Berrigan, a poet David Everhart, and myself, a young artist beginning a career in liturgical art in Baltimore, and that disrupted our lives immediately. We went into a draft board in Baltimore. We opened the 1A file drawer, and we poured blood on the files. Immediately, we were arrested, and that began the process that led to the Catonsville Nine, where we were sent to jail from 2 to 3 to 4 years. The Nine, the witnesses really said to the public that nonviolence is still alive. People are willing to take serious risk to protest this war in Vietnam, which we did. And they changed our lives. And as I said tonight, that I have no regrets for this at all. In fact, I think my art has improved. Philip, Daniel and I worked on a book together in maximum security at the Baltimore County Jail after the Catonsville Nine. We were all held together. I used coffee grounds for ink. Daniel wrote poetry on the floor. The materials were not so good, but I think the art improved.
Tom, I have to interrupt for a minute to ask, when you made the decision in terms of the Baltimore Four or the Catonsville Nine, when you burned draft files with napalm, you didn't know at the time how you would be dealt with. How did you make this decision? Did you think you could be put in prison for many, many years?
We knew we were taking a risk because draft resistors were being sent to prison. And people were being sent to prison for 2 years. We knew that there was a serious risk involved. We did not consider the risk as much as the importance of the witness, the importance of making a statement against the war in Vietnam. And we used a weapon of the army, in fact, to destroy the records, we used homemade napalm made from a special forces handbook to really illustrate the outrageousness of the use of napalm. Instead of using it on people, we used it on death certificates.
And you went into the Catonsville Army office where the draft records were kept?
We actually went into the Knights of Columbus building. They had a dance hall on the basement floor and the draft board on the top floor. And we took the records out and we burnt them in a parking lot. We stood around, we prayed, and the police came and we were arrested. And that began our process of arrest, prison, trial.
Kathy Boylan, you heard about this action how?
I was 24 on May 17th, 1968, when Catonsville happened. And in the afternoon, while I was taking care of my babies, I turned on the radio and heard the radio report about our Tom and Phil and the others burning the draft files. And it must have been a very short announcement, imagine a minute, but it so struck my heart that I believe I stood up a different person. I wanted to meet these people who were so brave to try to stop war.
Were you an activist at the time?
No, I was not. I was a young mother, and I was the most I was doing was a CCD teacher in our local parish.
Which means?
Teaching religion. I had grown up a Catholic in Catholic schools, but I never knew we were called to resist war.
Your husband an official in the Long Island Lighting Company?
At that time, no, at Con Edison.
Con Ed.
But, you know, it certainly caused an upheaval in my life, in our life, and has led me to try to follow the example of these peacemakers that Philip try to follow the example that he has given.
And when did you first meet Philip?
I met him in 1972 in December, I think it was December 20th, when he was released from Danbury Prison after serving his term for the Catonsville and the Baltimore Four Action. And I was in the crowd. I'm so happy I was in that crowd of people who gathered on a very cold day. And I also remember that no church would welcome Philip for a festival of celebration after he was released from prison. So we had to have the celebration in a bar. And so that was interesting. And then one of the actions, I just want to mention that I was part of a Plowshares action in 91. And in that action, I was in court when a federal judge called Philip Berrigan the conscience of a generation.
What was that action?
That was the Aegis Plowshares up at Bath, Maine.
And what did you do?
We hammered on the missile hatches, thank you, missile hatches of the nuclear weapons on a nuclear weapon carrier called the Aegis Destroyer. And we were all arrested and taken to court.
What did the judge say?
The judge asked Philip Berrigan to stand, and then he said, "Philip Berrigan, I know you are the conscience of a generation. And I know that we were refusing to sign for personal recognizance to be released from prison." And the judge told Philip that, "I know that if you say you're coming back for trial, you'll be back for trial. And I know that's true of your friends." So he released us all.
That was then. In fact, you've just come out of serving another prison term. Is that right?
For trying to close the SOA, or WISC, the School of the Americas, which is one of the 110 terrorist training camps run by the Pentagon. And that's at Fort Benning, Georgia.
And so how long did you
serve? I served 3 months.
Elmer Moss, as we go in a kind of chronological order, you were one of the people involved with the 1980s Plowshares Aid Action at the General Electric plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
You did this with Phil Berrigan. Can you talk about what you did?
Sure, I'd be glad to. On the morning of September 9th, 1980, eight folks, Philip and Daniel Berrigan, John Shushard and Dean Hammer, who are here, Carl Cabot, Ann Montgomery and Molly Rush and myself entered the General Electric plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and with simple household hammers, with our own blood that symbolized the blood that would be shed should these weapons be used, hammered upon Mark 12A nose cones that were in production at that plant. We destroyed two of those nose cones, and then we poured our blood on two other cones that had been carbon bonded for their trip through the atmosphere, and we also poured our blood on blueprints and on documents that were part of the preparation and the manufacture and the production of these weapons.
This was the founding Plowshares action?
This was the first of the Plowshares series. Folks had become increasingly concerned. This was 1980, perhaps one of the most dangerous years in the whole history of the arms race. The United States had 32,000 weapons, was capable of blowing up the world with its arsenal over 65 times over. We were moving into a technology hidden from the public and lied to by the government about a technology that would, in fact, be a first-strike, war-initiating, offensive technology, far from the defensive posture that was publicly identified as the United States position. And the Mark 12A nose cone that we addressed at the King of Prussia plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, was a key part of this first-strike war-initiating technology.
What was the reaction of the authorities when you moved in?
Well, we had a sense that they were displeased by what we did. We were arrested, and we were taken to the jail, and then we were charged with 13 charges by the end of the day that could have landed us in prison had we been convicted on all of them and sentenced on all of them to 165 years. So there was a certain element of displeasure in the authorities' response to what we did. We did, of course, eventually go to trial and were sentenced to prison terms from that.
You're sitting next to John Shuchart, who is an attorney was one of those who was actively participating in the Plowshares 8, this first action. What was Phil Berrigan's role in it, John?
Well, Phil was, I suppose, to us and many others, a moral exemplar. We had all been deeply impressed by the courage and the conviction which he displayed as the first Catholic priest to go to prison for reasons of conscience in American history. And so there's no question that that Phil gave courage and inspiration to all of us to form this Plowshares 8 action at General Electric.
Can you tell us what happened when you got to prison? One of the things Phil Berrigan always talked about was the action was as important once you got inside the prison and the work you did there as the action itself, looking at the war abroad and the war at home. Can you talk about how bail was set and then what happened from there?
Yes. Well, certainly Phil was the same man inside a prison or out. So his concerns and his priorities were scripture study and prayer and then justice, the question of justice. And when he saw and got to know the other men imprisoned with us and saw the extreme injustice of the charges being multiplied, he certainly supported my moving into the law library at Montgomery County Prison, and there were some excellent self-educated lawyers serving time there. We got to working together to address some of the extreme injustices of the criminal justice system. We had been imprisoned on, as Elmer said, 13 multiplied and fabricated charges. They used their imagination and law books throughout the entire day, at the end of which, when we were facing this 165 years in prison, I remember the voice of Elmer Moss in a darkened prison cell saying, "This is the happiest day of my life." That gave me a little change of perspective myself. And
what was bail set at originally?
Bail was denied in the first instance. The prosecutor said that we should all be, there should be no bail whatsoever. Essentially, we should be presumed guilty and were a danger to the community. Of course, he was protecting the most extreme danger to humanity, which is thermonuclear genocidal weapons. But after a time, the bail was reduced, I think, to about $1 million. And as we became developed friendships within the Montgomery County Prison and developed solidarity and decided to undertake a prison-wide fast and day of silence calling for recognition of January 15th as a national holiday, Martin Luther King's birthday, and then particularly as we began to file petitions and motions and objections to the extreme injustice that was suffered by all of the other men in prison with us. We found the bail beginning, we were informed it was lower. And I forget how it went from 500 to 150. We were almost on the auction block. And then one day, in late January, the jailers came in and said, sign a promise to appear and you can be released today.
Wait one second. I want to go back to Elmer Moss for a second. Maybe you remember the exact numbers, Elmer. In terms of the bail that was set, because this is very interesting to see what happened. Original bail?
Yeah, John is essentially correct. That it started with no bail, then $1 million, and then $500,000.
$500,000. So you're all being told this in the prison?
Yes, we were told there would be no way out, and then it got lower and lower and lower as John's suits kept going out of the building, and one thing or another, we had the action.
Were these class action suits on behalf of the prisoners or individual lawsuits?
They were individual motions challenging the injustices, the fabricated evidence, the multiplied charges.
In other people's cases that had nothing
cases.
To do with Plowshares.
Right. Right. The criminal justice system is a chamber of horrors, and if the American people knew what was being done in the name of justice, I think they would rise up against it. But in any event, I had been public defender of Windham County, Vermont, so I was well equipped to file these motions on behalf of any number of men. And
so soon they got you down to, say, $100. If you all would pay, you'd be out.
We'd be out. And then
and
they came
say?
In and just simply signed this piece of paper.
So now they had dropped all bail.
All bail, all conditions, except signing a piece of paper, which we said we would not do because our action was entirely legal and what they were doing was entirely criminal and we wouldn't participate in any part of it. Well, no, they came back, they left, and about 2 days later, rather late at night as I remember, they came in and put their hands on their, these are the jailers, put their hands on their hips and said, you've got two choices. Either you walk out of here or we're going to drag you out.
And so they put you out on the street with all of your belongings?
Well, we said we would walk out.
There's a famous picture of you, isn't there, that appeared in the newspaper of the group of you on the street with your belongings outside of the prison.
Yes, in the middle of the night.
We're also joined by Dean Hammer, another member of the Plowshares 8, and you're involved with another action as well.
Correct, and I'd like to talk about my 3 months of living with Phil on the heels of the Plowshares 8. During the first 4 days, Dan stayed in jail with Phil as a cellmate, and then Dan left because of medical reasons. He had a very bad back and other medical problems, and the Jesuits helped Dan leave. And then as I walked into the cell, along with Phil was this other person on what was called the Cadillac. They brought in an extra cot in a two-person cell. And on this Cadillac sat a very robust biker, and he had a swastika on his arm. And having been raised in the synagogue as a Jew, I kind of knocked my head and said, how am I going to deal with this? And slowly on, Phil would have us study the Beatitudes every morning during the hour and a half when we were locked down. So every morning they lock all the prisoners up and make sure that we remember that we're in jail. And so it was really stunning to me how the study of the Beatitudes helped the swastika essentially disappear. And this fellow Ken and I, after 3 months, I parted friends with him. In addition to that, during the time when they would open up the tier, we opened up the study of the Beatitudes to the other prisoners. And by the time I left after 3 months...
Explain what Beatitudes
are. The Beatitudes are a section of the Gospel of Matthew and Luke. The Sermon on the Mount is one of the most famous teachings of Jesus. Begins, blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall know God. And by the time that I left jail, there were no less than 9 prisoners studying the Beatitudes with us, during a time when most of the prisoners were playing cards for cigarettes. And I found that rather stunning, the way that the prisoners knew that Phil was a priest, all the while the Catholic Church had defrocked him. So the prisoners really had a wisdom that well surpassed the actions of the church. The other story that I would like to remember is when they took us to court from the jail, the court was on the other side of the street, they would chain the five of us men to a common chain. And we were pranced across the street, and all the cars had to stop. And we were essentially shuttled across the street like cattle. And I was fresh out of Yale Divinity School. I was about 26 years old at that point. And I had this moment of kind of insight that this is where Yale had brought me, from Yale to jail. And it was really quite an honor to be in a common bondage with Phil and the other four brothers.
Well, we have to break, and I want to thank you all for describing your experiences. I think what became clear through the wake as people got up one by one and spoke, that while Phil's body lay in the church, his legacy clearly continues through each one of you. You are listening to Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from St. Peter Claver Church, where Phil Berrigan first came in the mid-1960s, before he began his actions from the Baltimore Four to the Catonsville Nine, and then the founding of the Plowshares Movement with his brother Dan Berrigan and some of the people you have just been listening to, like Dean Hammer and John Shushart, Elmer Moss, Tom Lewis, Kathy Boylan telling us how she was inspired. We'll be back in a minute.
Everyone beneath their vine and fig tree shall live at peace and not afraid. And if the plowshares turn their swords, nations shall learn war no more. And if the plowshares turn their swords, nations shall learn war no more. And everyone beneath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and not afraid. Everyone beneath their vine, fig tree, shall live in peace and not afraid. And into plowshares turn their swords, nations shall learn war no more. And into plowshares turn their swords, nations shall learn war no more. Phil Berrigan, presente! Presente!
Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from St. Peter Claver Church in Baltimore, where the funeral for Philip Berrigan will be held later today. We have just finished the wake. Hundreds of people gathered inside the church, and for hours they spoke and remembered Philip Berrigan, the anti-war activist, the religious rebel, the radical anti-war militant, some would say. He was arrested more than 100 times. He was involved in many actions, one of the founders of the Plowshares movement. And we're joined right now by three people, Jackie Allen, Kathleen Rumpf, and Father John Deere, all who have worked with with Philip Berrigan and Dan Berrigan. Some have, Father John Deere has served time in prison with him. Jackie Allen, you talked about Philip Berrigan at the wake. Can you talk about your memories of him and how you got involved with the Plowshares action, the Griffiths action, and where it was?
Yes, the Griffiths action was up in Rome, New York in 1983. Time flies. I think I became involved partly after hearing Philip and Liz McAllister speak, and was very moved by what they had to say and began spending time with them and studying with them and preparing to do a Plowshares action.
Can you talk about Anne Montgomery, who was involved with, was she involved with one of the first Plowshares?
She was in the first and a number of, like she's done four or five Plowshares actions, mm-hmm. Yes. And she's in, I believe she's with the Christian Peacekeepers team right now. And
in
so she wasn't able
territories.
To be here, yes.
That's right. Yep. And the story she told about Phil Berrigan.
Yes. Part of the preparation for the plowshares was doing role plays so that you were ready to face the consequences of being stopped or checked by the military when you were in the course of doing your action. And Phil was helping with the preparation for that and being very rough and playing the part of a security guard that came upon a group of people doing a plowshares action. He was kind of tossing people around and yelling and giving orders, and some of us are quite intimidating, get a little freaked out, and Anne kind of told Phil, okay, Phil, that's good, that's good, that's good. You know, and after it got quiet, she looked over and put her hand on our arm and said, that's why we thank God every day that he's on our side. I think my father was a lieutenant colonel in the Army and a very strict Catholic, and in a lot of ways I think that Phil was a warrior for peace, and I think he had the same commitment and dedication that you would see in career military people in his work with the peace movement, and that his commitment was total, and he believed the sacrifices were as great as those who would go to serve in a war.
And the Griffiths action, where was that? When was it?
It was in Rome, New York. It was the Strategic Air Command, where B-52s were being retrofitted to carry cruise missiles in the early 80s.
And what did you do?
And seven of us crossed a cow pasture fence into the golf course on the Air Force Base on Thanksgiving at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we were able to walk into an empty hangar and hammer on the bomb bay doors of a B-52 and two of the engines. And there was no one in sight, and we were able to hang up an indictment of the first strike nuclear weapon system, and we actually were able to call through a base operator to talk to our supporters on the outside, and ended up having to flag down a security vehicle to be arrested.
You flagged down a security vehicle to be arrested?
Yeah, I think he told us he was going to take us to the Burger King because we were not allowed to protest on the property. So Kathleen mentioned to him that he might want to look inside the hangar before he drove us off the base.
And Kathleen Rumpf, you too involved with the Griffiths action. What would he see if he looked inside the hangar?
Well, when they got to the hangar, they looked inside and saw the B-52. And we had hammered on the bomb bay doors. We put pictures of our children on the door, on the B-52. We pasted a 15-page indictment indicting the whole chain of command. We spray-painted swords into plowshares, left our symbols. So within minutes, while they were waiting and checking the hangar, we were waiting with military after we waved them down. Within minutes, there were about 18 soldiers running double time towards us with M16 rifles, and we lay on the ground with rifles pointed at us after we had waved them down. And we were charged with sabotage, destruction of government property, and conspiracy. And so we're the first protesters onto an actual military facility, a SAC base that had recently won an award for its security. And during trial, we had a 6-week trial, but we came to know the jury and the court very well. And by the end of the trial, we had produced so much testimony, and the jury heard so much that they realized and made the distinction between first strike weapons and conventional weapons. And we were acquitted of sabotage because these B-52s were first strike weapons.
Offensive and not defensive.
And they were offensive and not defensive weapons. But I probably am the most unlikely person that I can think of to do a plowshares. I was coming out of the Catholic Worker in New York. I had lived
with
the homeless.
Explain what the Catholic Worker is.
The Catholic Worker is a movement started by Dorothy Day and Peter Morin. And it was basically the radical works of mercy, feeding the hungry, sheltering the homeless, clothing the naked. And I spent many years with the homeless. And when I heard about the Plowshares action and met Philip and Daniel and other friends who are here tonight and went to court and heard their words, I was so moved, and they were so prophetic. And I approached the Plowshares in a very different way after living with the homeless for so many years. And seeing the face of the homeless change so radically, when I first lived on and worked at the Bowery, it was mostly what we call derelicts. But as our priorities as a government changed, it became women and children And I didn't understand why it became acceptable that we had high chairs in soup kitchens in America. And when I approached the idea of maybe doing a plowshares, I never considered myself a spokesperson of any kind. But I knew I wanted to speak on behalf of where the money wasn't being spent and for the homeless. And it didn't matter to me about the bombs dropping because people were dropping as a result of our resources going into the making and testing, and people were dropping all along me, around me in the streets.
You're a very well-known peace activist in Syracuse and, well, beyond there. And you're also well-known for moving into a cage in the public square in Syracuse. What were you demonstrating? Can you talk about that jail that Philip Berrigan has spent time in?
That's right. Phil, Dan, many of us have been in the Syracuse jail, all of us plowshares from the Griffiths. I built a cage in front of our jail on the plaza after knocking on all the doors in our county and city because I was working in the jail when I got out of prison from Alderson. And I found out they were shackling our prisoners naked on the bars, stretched out, and they called it the Jesus Christ. Already the conditions...
The position they were in.
The position they were in. The deputies called it the Jesus Christ. The prisoners called it the Jesus Christ. I tried to stop it, and every door was slammed in my face.
Explain how the prisoners were held?
The prisoners were held with their hands above their heads, shackled high on the bars, and their feet were shackled too, and a sheet was wrapped around the chains between their feet and tied under the bunk, so they would pull them taut. And they were hanging at a slant. Mm. And they called this, with the Syracuse helmet, Syracuse football helmet hanging on their heads. I did build a cage in front of the jail after getting no response and lived in it for 10 days with a sign that said low-income housing. And from there, I found deputies who would tell the truth.
60 Minutes did a big piece. Did it matter? How did you get them to stop?
When the 60 Minute piece aired and Physicians for Human Rights went on calling it on air, calling it torture, documenting it as torture. The jailers said that they would continue, and they did continue until it took a few more years of work with a legal injunction against the jail.
Kathleen Rumpf, you did your Griffiths action with Jackie Allen and with Liz McAllister,
yes.
Who is married to Phil Berrigan. You all served your time at Alderson. Philip Berrigan is also known for his acerbic wit, for his sense of humor. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, I personally took it upon me to make Phil laugh as much as I possibly could. I would send him letters in prison soaked in perfume and send him outrageous cards, especially Valentine's Day. I mean, there's things I can't speak about, and I remember going on retreat and being asked, you know, what room I would like to sleep in, and I would say, well, of course, Phil Berrigan's. You know, we had great fun, and Phil was just this wonderful, warm, warm, dear man, and I was so grateful. He really taught me what it was like to be a human being in this world. And not only to be a human being, but to stand up, and that every voice counts, every action counts.
Father John Deere, we're going to wrap up with you. You were involved with the Pax Christi Spirit of Life Plowshares December 7th, 1993. Where was that?
In Goldsboro, North Carolina, at the Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, which is the time, the cutting edge of the U.S. Air Force, where they have the F-15, which can carry nuclear weapons, which was used to the slaughter of Basra at the end of the Gulf War and was on alert to bomb Bosnia that night. And we thought the base was going to be empty. And Phil and I and two friends at 4 in the morning walked several miles through the base and came upon 10,000 soldiers in the middle of war games. And I remember, Phil, we were on the top of a bluff overlooking all of this. We were all thinking, you know, the place is going to be empty. And Phil going, oh, my God, at 4 a.m. while we sleep, the war machine barrels on full steam ahead. It was shocking to see. And we all looked at Phil. What do we do, Phil? And I was kind of hoping he'd say, let's turn around and go get some breakfast. And he said, we're going on ahead. And we walked right on ahead, and, you know, nobody caught us. And we walked right through the soldiers to this one bomber, and we took out hammers invoking Isaiah and bombed, hammered once or twice on the fighter bomber. We're immediately arrested and kicked and surrounded by 50 soldiers and then 500 soldiers and then 1,000 soldiers.
Did they think you were part of the war game?
At first they did, and we explained that we weren't. But we were found guilty and convicted of 2 felony charges and faced 20 years in prison. And the thing about me and Phil was that Phil and I did 8.5 months in the same cell, the size of a little tiny bathroom.
Where?
Majority of the time in the Edendon County Jail in North Carolina, which is a rural little town. And by that I mean, you know, 8 feet by 5 feet, an open toilet and 2 bunk beds, and we never left the cell except for 3 days during those 8 months. So, I mean, it was so horrible and was so spectacular experience, so wonderful and holy to be with Phil. And we went through so much together, and I would wake up and, on the one hand, it was so horrible, but I, you know, for Phil, for me, as my friends were saying, he was conscience, but a saint, a prophet, and such a hero and a holy man. And I think, wow, it's like being in a cell with Gandhi or Dr. King. So we talked, and we would, it's the two of us and our friend Bruce. We were up at 6, and we would have 3 hours of Bible study, do about 3 verses and talk. Then we would have Wonder Bread that came through the door. We would break the Wonder Bread and the little plastic cup of grape juice and have our Eucharist. And it was, we lived like monks and ate meals and wrote letters and took naps and told stories.
And do you think your action, these actions that we've heard about, have made a difference?
Oh, an enormous difference. Yeah, there have been some 80 Plowshares actions, and I'm convinced they're going to continue. But we don't know the effect. You know, it's a whole, that's why it really is in the end, I think our actions were an experience of faith for me, because you just kind of, as we were saying tonight, Phil always said, you do the best you can and then you leave the rest to the God of peace. And we always try to leave the outcome and the results in the hands of the God of peace. And miracles were happening all over, literally from the Seymour Johnson Air Force Base that day where they shut down the war games, to all these weapons that have been dismantled, to the millions of people that have been inspired by Phil and these actions that have borne all kinds of fruit and all kinds of smaller actions and other good works. And you just do the good because it's good. You do the right thing because it's right. You beat swords into plowshares because we have to do it.
Father John Deere, talking about the life of Philip Berrigan. Philip Berrigan will be buried today in Baltimore, Maryland. That does it for today's program. Our program was guest produced by Jeremy Scahill, with help from Democracy Now! Producer Alex Wolf here in Baltimore, Maryland. In New York, our producers Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Anna Noguera, and Angie Caron. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro. Special thanks to Philip Shipman and Catherine Campbell, also Dennis Moynihan, as well as Carmen Trotta of The Catholic Worker. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
In World War II, I flew the bombing missions. Now with every blow I strike today, I say the bombs will never fall.